sense in the very big picture, but it doesn't work exactly like that. Most or all of these substitutes for gang masculinity have been present in every kind of social organization and civilization. There have almost always been sports, and men who enjoyed watching sports and other contests of strength, speed, or agility. Primitive and civilized people alike have told stories of great deeds and reflected on what it meant to be a good man. Humans have been trading and negotiating for a long time, and there have almost always been priests and monks and ascetics. Further, most or all of these methods of channeling gang masculinity can be present in and important to any given man. There are and have always been pious warriors and athletes. Manly men are generally expected to be good men, to exercise self-restraint, and to behave ethically. Men who we see as men of action will still take political sides or debate with one another. Men who play sports usually enjoy watching them. Overcoming internal struggles is essential to overcoming external struggles, to surviving, and to achieving anything. So, both individual men and civilizations can and do channel masculinity through simulation, vicariousness, and intellectualization at any point in their development. What changes is emphasis and opportunity. Because gangs are a threat to order, unless they are organized in the service of a civilization, opportunities for the direct experience of gang masculinity, participation in war-making, protecting, and defending, will generally be available to a smaller proportion of the male population, as the big gang that runs the civilization, through one means or another, attains impunity. Some men will fight, but fewer. Modern technology speeds this up. If you have the ability to attack safely and indirectly with remote drones, few men will ever have to kill anyone directly. The plenty produced by modern technology also reduces the opportunity for men to engage in wars on nature, as James put it. Fewer and fewer men will be required to work actively with their hands, as they would have in a primitive survival gang. Agriculture will replace group hunting, and machine-driven agribusiness or state-run agriculture will turn the trade of farming into a low-skill job that requires no emotional investment from men. Hunting gives way to the conveyor belt slaughterhouse, and the efficiency of that system ensures that even fewer men will be required to participate in the hunting process. Hunting survives for most men only as a sport. We get our meat from the supermarket. For most of us today, what we do to get the money to buy the meat has little or nothing to do with hunting. It doesn't have to happen this way, but it has. As opportunities for men to do what they evolved to do decrease, greater emphasis is placed on simulated, vicarious, and intellectualized channels of masculinity to maintain order and cultural unity. Men still get to feel like men, but the threat that men pose to order, to established interests, and to the interests of women, is mitigated. Men compete for status, and they want to earn peer approval, so the channels for masculinity that appeal to them will be related to their natural aptitudes and temperament. Guys with thin frames and high metabolisms may not make the best powerlifters, but they usually make good runners. Likewise, intellectuals and verbally gifted men take especially well to intellectualized channels of masculinity. Most men are talented evenly enough that they can remain engaged by a mix of simulated, intellectualized, and vicarious forms of masculinity so long as they are otherwise invested in a given civilization. A minority of men need extremely frequent opportunities for vital, immediate equivalents to hunting and war to keep them productive and to keep them from self-destructing. Charles Darwin thought that these restless men were a great check to civilization, but that they could make useful pioneers. These men tend to get into a lot of trouble in higher civilizations. They fill our prisons and often have problems with substance abuse, whereas they'd probably do pretty well in a survival scenario. Another small number of men are happy to live almost completely in their heads, and are easily satisfied by intellectual pursuits and abstract demonstrations of masculinity. Just as jocks brag that real men play sports because they are good at them, abstract thinkers will pretend they have conquered their baser instincts by simply doing what they are naturally good at. Men compete for status, and they want to feel like they're winning. Once you recognize this, debates between men about the true nature of masculinity become amusingly predictable. Engineers think manhood is all about technology. Liberal arts majors think it is all about civilized virtue. And athletes think masculinity is all about strength, speed, and perseverance. Effeminate males think they are more evolved than their brutish brothers and thus the truly better men. In a balanced, unified, patriarchal society that provides opportunities for the majority of men to put their talents to use, all of those guys can be right, at least partially. They can all demonstrate strength, courage, mastery, and honor to their peers in different ways. And they can all feel valued by a set of peers. Ideally, those guys could cultivate a modicum of respect for their different roles. Though since status-seeking is the way of men, men with healthy egos will usually believe that their own role is just a little more important and a little bit better. Unfortunately, we've reached a level of civilization, technology, and plenty that, to protect order and established interests, opportunities for vital, immediate equivalents to hunting and war are increasingly rare. Weapons technology has made war too deadly and too easy for men willing to use that technology to get what they want at all costs. Lawyers and insurance companies and more technology have made dangerous, exciting, and engaging jobs safe, easy, and boring. Only a select few guardians, workers in shrinking and outsourced fields, and men who favor intellectual channels of masculinity are satisfactorily engaged in activities where they feel like they are risking, struggling, and winning. Everyone else is just playing around and they know it. Men are dropping out and disengaging from our slick, easy, safe world. For what may be the first time in history, the average guy can afford to be careless. Nothing he does really matters. And what's worse, there is a shrinking hope of any future where what he does will matter. Pornography is not the same as sex. It's a substitute for it. Would pornography lose its appeal without the possibility of sex? Will war and survival simulations be enough without even the remotest possibility of war or strife? Will they simply become empty, depleting, and depressing? This is one reason why people love zombie movies and disaster porn so much. The apocalypse, any apocalypse, offers an opportunity. As the back cover of The Walking Dead comic book reads, quote, "In a world ruled by the dead, we are forced to finally start living," end quote. The compromise between modern civilization and manliness promoted by intellectuals is, predictably, an increased emphasis on intellectualized channels for masculinity. There are a few problems with this. For starters, not all men are intellectuals, so they are going to suck at that game. No one likes losing all the time. Ask any nerd or fag who has been bullied. If only a minority of men are intellectuals, and intellectualized masculinity is all we have, the majority of men are going to feel like they are losing all the time. If you want to create a society of listless, antisocial losers, convince the majority of your men that they're already losing, and no matter what they do, they will never be able to win. What's the point in trying if you know the game is rigged? For the satisfaction of knowing you're contributing to the greater good? That's just the kind of stupid thing an intellectual would say. Another problem with the complete intellectualization of masculinity is that intellectualized masculinity is pretty much equally accessible to women. Demonstrating your manliness to other men doesn't mean much if women are doing all of the same things that men are doing. Intellectual courage isn't particularly specific to men or the role of men. Women can be equally intellectually courageous. Women can screw each other over in business just as well as men can, maybe even better. Women can demonstrate self-mastery. They can be good citizens. Women can be morally upright. And while, as a group, they lag in the sciences, there are women who can compete with men in every academic field. Intellectualized masculinity is only workable when masculinity is intellectualized differently than femininity, and men are not forced to compete with women. If men are subconsciously trying to demonstrate their worthiness as men to other men, and then find themselves competing with women, it kind of blows the whole illusion. The introduction of women into a field of competition short-circuits its viability as a substitute for male gang activity. The restless men who sense that they will never be pioneers, who will never build a fire, keep watch over the camp, or fight for their lives, may turn out to be the check of civilization. Look at what hopeless, directionless, angry young black men have done to the cities that were never theirs. See how well the once proud Aztecs reacted to the rape of their cities and foreign rule. White men are equally capable of bringing down a future they have no place in. A future built on dreams that are not their own. The emotional needs of men are not being met by a world that repudiates the way of men. But so long as their material needs are being met, men may choose not to make war against the world. As long as they have enough stuff, enough food, enough distractions, men may be content to dull their senses, tune out, and allow themselves to become slaves to the interests of women, bureaucrats, and wealthy men. The Bonobo Masturbation Society. What would happen if men got spoiled, gave up, and gave in to women completely? How would that society operate? The evolutionary theory of parental investment suggests that because reproduction is costly, members of the sex which makes the lesser parental investment will compete for sexual access to whichever sex makes the greater parental investment. In humans and most mammals, females are forced to make the greatest investment in reproduction. Human females carry their children for 9 months, and they are highly vulnerable and less mobile during the later stages of pregnancy. Giving birth itself is traumatic, and death during childbirth was more common in the past than it is today. After birth, the mother remains especially vulnerable for a short period, and a human child is extremely vulnerable for several months and will remain vulnerable for several years. Nursing is another investment required of human mothers until recently. Human males have it comparatively easy. We can pass on our genes in a matter of minutes and then skip town unless we are persuaded to stick around by females, social controls, or shotgun-wielding fathers. Human males evolved to compete for access to females because female reproductive investment is a valuable prize. Males can exist in the all-male world of the gang, but females quite literally represent the future. Men create a perimeter and establish security. They create a rudimentary hierarchy, order, and seminal culture of us versus them. To perpetuate us, they need women. So they try to figure out how to get women, and how to get access to their reproductive investment. Major West, a character in the zombie movie 28 Days Later, tells a story reminiscent of the founding of Rome. He gives the rationale for the rape of the Sabine women in just a few lines. Quote, 8 days ago, I found Jones with his gun in his mouth. He said he was going to kill himself because there was no future. What could I say to him? We fight off the infected, or we wait until they starve to death. And then what? What do 9 men do except wait to die themselves? I moved us from the blockade, and I set the radio broadcasting, and I promised them women. Because women mean a future. End quote. The way of men is the way of the gang, but a gang of men alone has no future. The all-male gang ends with the death of the last man. Men want to be remembered. They want their tradition to survive, and they want sex. Ultimately, these psychological mechanisms and desires will allow them to pass on their genes. When there is competition for resources, including women, it is good strategy for a gang of men to create a patriarchal hierarchy, eliminate neighboring rival gangs, take their women, and protect those women from other rival gangs. This is exactly what many primitive tribes do. This is the basic strategy of the gang. What happens when competition for resources is radically reduced? What happens when women get their way? Two of our closest primate relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, illustrate some of the differences between the way of males and the way of females. Wrangham and Peterson argued that, in spite of cultural determinist theories and a lot of wishful thinking about peaceful prehistoric matriarchies, the evolutionary, archaeological, historical, anthropological, physiological, and genetic evidence overwhelmingly suggests that humans have always been a patriarchal, male-bonded, party gang species that engaged in regular coalitionary violence. This was a brave conclusion because both authors seem to be wholeheartedly against violence. As self-described evolutionary feminists, they offered suggestions as to how we might end male violence now that men have the means to wreak havoc well beyond what their primitive ancestors could do with powerful arms and simple tools. Aside from selective breeding to reduce violent alpha tendencies in males, a program that seems to be underway, albeit accidentally, and the establishment of a one-world government, Wrangham and Peterson suggested that we look to the gentle bonobo apes for guidance. Chimpanzees and bonobos are both close relatives of humans. Both have much in common with people, but when it comes to social structures, the chimps are more apt to live in small groups led by a hierarchical gang of males, whereas the bonobos tend to live in larger, more stable parties with a greater number of females, and the females maintain coalitions that check male violence. Chimpanzees organize to the benefit of male reproductive interest, and bonobos organize to the benefit of female reproductive interests. Chimps follow the way of men. Bonobos follow the way of women. The chimpanzee way. Chimpanzees can mingle in larger parties if they are able to make alliances and if food is plentiful. Chimps and humans prefer high-quality foods, and male chimps actively hunt for meat, especially red colobus monkeys. Chimpanzees compete for resources when they are scarce, so they break up into smaller gangs. This is a party gang social structure because of this flexibility in party size. Under stress, they revert to patriarchal gangs run by male relatives and bonded male allies. Females move and are moved from gang to gang. Males compete for sexual access to females, but males also sometimes court the females and escort them away from the stress of male competition. Females who do not have children sometimes join males in hunting and raiding activities. Females are subordinate to males in the chimpanzee social hierarchy, and they are expected to demonstrate submission. When a young male comes of age, he will usually make a big show of it and start pushing females around until they acknowledge him as an adult male. After he achieves that, he'll stop making such a big to-do. However, chimpanzee males do batter females sporadically to maintain their status and show the gals what's what. Males who come of age spend a lot of time together, but also spend a lot of time competing for status with each other. Their contests are often violent, and on rare occasions, two males have been known to form an alliance and murder an alpha male. Humans might recognize this as patricide or tyrannicide. For chimps, in-group competition is less important than competition with other groups. Chimpanzees and humans are the only two members of the great apes where males form coalitions to go out and raid or eliminate members of a neighboring gang. Alpha chimps will occasionally gather up other males, go out to the edge of their range, try to catch a member of another gang unaware, and murder him. This is similar to the skulking way of war, common among primitive humans who also engage in guerrilla raiding. Over time, males will pick off all of the other males of the neighbor gang, absorb the remaining females into their own group, and mate with them. Because chimpanzees hunt, defend, and aggress as a coordinated gang, they have to be willing to put aside internecine competition and maintain close bonds with each other. Primatologist Franz De Waal wrote, quote, "The chimpanzee male psyche, shaped by millions of years of intergroup warfare in the natural habitat, is one of both competition and compromise. Whatever the level of competition among them, males count on each other against the outside. No male ever knows when he will need his greatest foe. It is, of course, this mixture of camaraderie and rivalry among males that makes chimpanzee society so much more recognizable to us than the social structure of the other great apes." End quote. The Bonobo Way. Bonobos eat many of the same foods that chimpanzees like, and they will eat meat when they find it. However, bonobos don't share their territory with gorillas, so they are able to eat the kinds of portable herbs that gorillas eat. Wrangham and Peterson believe that this is one of the key differences between chimps and bonobos. Bonobos have a staple food source that is easy to find. They don't have to compete for resources even when many foods are out of season, so they can more or less relax all year long in a piece of plenty. The males compete for status, but they seem less concerned about it because status for bonobo males doesn't mean much. Bonobos don't compete for mates. Each male just waits his turn, and the females are happy to oblige anyone who comes knocking. For bonobos, sex is social, and bonobos have both homosexual and heterosexual sex. Bonobo males don't know who their kids are, because any of the kids could be their kids. The mother makes all of the parental investment. Bonobo males do know who their mothers are, and they remain bonded to them for life. They often follow their mothers around throughout adulthood, and mothers intervene in conflicts on behalf of their sons. Males don't spend a lot of time together in bonobo groups, but females build strong friendships with one another. When males start trouble, the females band together and put a stop to it quickly. Bonobo females are in charge. When one group of bonobos comes in contact with another group, the female bonobos will be the ones who make peace, and generally they will start engaging in hoka-hoka with each other. That's what the natives call bonobo girl-on-girl action. Then the females will start mating with the males from the opposite group. The males just sit around and watch, shrug their shoulders, and eventually join in. A conflict of interests. Bonobos and chimpanzees are adapted to different environments, and their social structures follow from what those environments have to offer. Bonobo society favors female interests. Female coalitions hold sway over politics, and female bonding is more important than male bonding. Males are bonded to their mothers and don't know who their fathers are. Females stay together for life. In chimpanzee society, females are somewhat isolated and stay with their young while they are children, while males enjoy both rivalry and camaraderie and stay with their fathers, brothers, and male friends for life. Chimpanzee society favors male interests. Wrangham and Peterson believe that bonobos offer a threefold path to peace because they have managed to reduce violence between the sexes, reduce violence between males, and reduce violence between communities. In response to the mass destruction inherent to modern warfare, many men have searched for ways to abandon the warfare system that attends patriarchy, and they have looked to women for guidance on coalition building and finding a more peaceful way to live. Those who believe human warfare is somehow unnatural will find little objective support for this theory in history or the sciences. Human societies are complex, and aspects of both bonobo and chimpanzee patterns are familiar enough. But male aggression, male coalitional violence, and male political dominance have all been identified as human universals, meaning that evidence of these behaviors has been found in some form in almost every human society that has ever been studied. Scientists only began to study bonobos as a separate and distinct species in the 1950s, because bonobos evolved in a small, sheltered range. Chimpanzees have a much larger range and have adapted to more diverse environments. Chimps and humans clearly have more in common in terms of social organization. It is likely that while humans are smarter and have far more complex social arrangements than chimpanzees, male bonding and male coalitional violence have been constant features of human and pre-human societies. Some researchers have suggested that bonobos aren't as peaceful as Wrangham and Peterson believed, but it does seem clear that they are more peaceful and matriarchal than chimps, and that their lifestyle is similar to what I've described. As a metaphor for what happens to men living in a secure peace of plenty like our own, the bonobo way looks eerily familiar. Aren't most men today spoiled mama's boys, without father figures, without hunting or fighting, or brother bonds, whose only masculine outlet is promiscuous sex? Wars against other men are known to fewer and fewer of us. Mandatory conscription for the Vietnam War ended the year before I was born. Since then, the United States has effectively created a class of professional contract soldiers who do the government's fighting in faraway lands. Average men know more about collegiate football than they know about a given overseas conflict. Like the bonobos, we don't have to worry about hunger. We barely have a reason to get up off the couch. Until the recent extended recession, jobs were fairly easy to come by, and almost all of the men who wanted to work were able to get a job. Welfare and social assistance programs provide safety nets for many others, and few American men living today grew up in a home without a television. True hunger and poverty and desperation, the way people know it in Africa, is rare, even for those who are officially considered poor. Diseases that wiped out populations in the past are treatable, and people recover fully from injuries that would have been fatal 100 years ago. If anything illustrates the surreal plenty we live in today, it is the fact that we have problems like epidemic obesity. People are able to sit in their homes and eat until they are so fat they can't move. Americans are obese in part because they simply don't do enough. It's hard to find a job doing the kind of back-breaking work that our ancestors did. I know, because I'm the kind of person who thinks a temp job digging ditches sounds like fun. I've actually looked. Our bodies have a tremendous capacity for work when we are conditioned for it. The human body is made to work hard. When there is no work to do, our physical health deteriorates. Doctors have to tell people to walk like it is some kind of breakthrough exercise technology. Once, I watched in awe as a personal trainer authoritatively led a pair of 40-something adults on a walk around their own neighborhood. He was a $75-an-hour human dog walker. The rest of us go to the gym to work out, which is just a substitute for doing physical work. People who answer emails for a living go to a special building where they trick their bodies into thinking they are actually doing the kind of work humans evolved to do. Activities like sandbag training and stone lifting and barefoot running are becoming popular. It's only a matter of time before someone comes up with a way to market a fitness craze where people run around spearing rubber mammoths. The goal of civilization seems to be to eliminate work and risk. But the world has changed more than we have. Our bodies crave work and sex. Our minds crave risk and conflict. It has always been striking to me that, even in our most popular visions of the future, we have been unable to eliminate conflict. Take Star Trek, for instance. On the surface, Star Trek is a modernist, feminist, egalitarian dream. Men and women and people of all races work side by side in a one-world meritocracy that seeks peace across the universe. But our fantasy isn't the peace, it's the conflict. Without some conflict between us and them, there is no plot. On Star Trek, they're always fighting someone. Many are attracted to peaceful platitudes like the ones heard in John Lennon's Imagine. But people aren't actually very good or very interested in imagining a future without conflict. If someone wrote a sci-fi show without conflict, would anyone watch? We are pretty good, however, at imagining inventive ways to masturbate our primal natures with safe, virtual, vicarious, and abstract pleasures. Our society has almost no tolerance for unsanctioned physical violence. Children are expelled from school for fighting, and something as historically common as a weaponless, drunken brawl can land men in court or in jail. As coalitions of females, pandering politicians, and fearful men organize to child-proof our world, to ban guns, and regulate violent sports, Men retreat to redoubts of virtual and vicarious masculinity like video games and fantasy football because it's all they have left. People are also seeking out other non-violent forms of simulated risk and safe adventure. From skydiving and bungee jumping to guided mountaineering and adventure races, men and women are coming up with more and more ways to simulate the primitive human experience. Women and men have similar drives in different degrees, and what I've noticed while participating in 5Ks and CrossFit and the Warrior Dash is that after the novelty of it wears off, attendance often becomes increasingly female. While some women participate competitively, many more women enjoy the experiences socially and emotionally, stopping along the way to cheer and encourage their struggling sisters. I get the sense that many husbands and boyfriends recognize the masturbatory, feel-good nature of these activities and shrug their shoulders, wondering why they would run through the mud in 90-degree heat for no good reason. From an evolutionary standpoint, it makes sense that women would tend to prefer and be more satisfied with safe and fun risk simulation, while men would long for real competition, real risk, and the potential of real status gains. The carefully orchestrated, sanitized, padded, insured, and permitted exercise rarely compares to the fantasy of virile action and meaningful risk. In video games, at least men experience virtual death. As physical competition for resources has decreased, sex has become increasingly social, as it is for the bonobos. Men and women hook up to satisfy their primal drive to reproduce. To the chagrin of masculinity's reimaginers, women still respond sexually to the kind of alpha traits and behaviors in men that would have made them good hunters and fighters. Displaying strength, courage, and mastery signals genetic superiority and high status to women, even women who have no plans to reproduce. Men seek out women who appear to be hardy and fertile, and women trick men's monkey brains with lipstick, liposuction, and breast implants. Sex today is increasingly disconnected from mating, and for many, it has become a matter of masturbating with someone else's body. In many cases, what that body offers is a disappointment compared to the risk-free sex that men can have virtually and vicariously through immediately available high-quality pornography. In 2003, feminist Naomi Wolf and writer David Amsden wrote that the simulated sexual experience was turning many men off to sex with real women, who felt that they had to compete with pornography for the attention of men. 2003. Wasn't that back when people actually still paid for porn? And a gigabyte still sounded like a big file? Today, young men can download high-definition pornography in moments and watch it on the same dazzling big-screen television that they bought to watch the Super Bowl. New York Magazine followed up in 2011 with a story titled "He's Just Not That Into Anyone," wherein the author reported faking an orgasm during real sex but having no problems climaxing when watching porn. Some of the men he interviewed for the story told him that they were experiencing erectile dysfunction during real sex, and others told him that they had to replay scenes from porn to get off while fucking their wives. Singer John Mayer confessed to Playboy magazine that there had probably been days where he had seen 300 vaginas before getting out of bed. Our world isn't offering men more paths to virile fulfillment or vital experience. What the modern world offers average men is 1,001 ways to safely spank our monkey brains into oblivion. Is it any wonder that some men ask themselves, in lucid moments between masturbating to various forms of vicarious sex and violence, what Betty Friedan wrote that educated housewives were asking themselves in the 50s? Is this all? We were born into a piece of plenty, a pleasure economy, a bonobo masturbation society. The future that our elite handlers have in store for us advertises more of the same. More detached pleasure, less risk, freedom from want, more masturbation. Reimaginers of masculinity offer us metaphorical battles to fight, but in the real world, the most meaningful battles will be fought between elite bureaucrats and experts and wealthy managers who believe they know what is best. While the rest of us shuffle off to boring, risk-free jobs to do idiot work and stare at the clock, waiting to go home and furiously indulge ourselves in whatever form of vicarious or virtual primitive experience gets us off. Cosmopolitan journalists from elite schools like Betty Friedan filled women's imaginations with fantasies of exciting big city careers that only a few could ever hope to attain. For every woman living that fantasy today, there are a bunch of women scanning merchandise through a checkout line at some big box retail store, or doing repetitive data entry in some gray office. In the East, women are answering our phone calls or performing monotonous assembly line tasks in factories. This is called progress. Many of those women would probably rather be spending more time actively engaged in the lives of their children, but they no longer have the choice to stay home. The cost of civilization is a progressive trade-off of vital existence. It's a trade-off of the real for the artificial, for the convincing con, made for the promise of security and a full belly. It has always been so. The question is, how much trade is too much? In the future that globalists and feminists have imagined for themselves, only a few people will actually do anything worth doing. A few people will be scientists, charged with uncovering the mysteries of the universe. A few people will be engineers who dream and design and solve problems. A few people will inhabit a privileged managerial class of financiers and bureaucrats, and they will make all of the decisions that matter for everyone else. They will captain companies and departments and build their great leviathans out of legal papers and fake smiles. There will also be, as there is now, a glamorous creative class charged with devising our sedentary entertainments. There will be gladiators and chariot races. There will be drama and theater people, and there will be global village gossip. Still, everyone can't be a chief, and most of us will still be Indians. Products need hordes of consumers and salespeople and customer service representatives and clerks and stock boys and loss prevention associates and midnight janitors. Anyone on the left-hand side of the bell curve, anyone who makes the wrong choices at the wrong time, anyone who doesn't jump through the hoops or play the game, anyone who hasn't been properly socialized, and anyone who turns down the wrong options for the right reasons will end up doing those drone jobs. As Matthew B. Crawford observed in his book Shop Class as Soulcraft, even so-called white-collar knowledge work is, quote, subject to routinization and degradation, proceeding by the same logic that hit manufacturing 100 years ago. The cognitive elements of the job are appropriated from professionals, instantiated into a system or process, and then handed back to a new class of workers, clerks, who replace the professionals. End quote. Being able to read and write at a college level doesn't mean the job you do will require much more thinking or consequential problem-solving than you would have to do as a shift manager at McDonald's. It will only save you from the greasy forehead. Only a couple 100 years ago, many of these men, now destined for clerkdom, would have learned a trade from their fathers and mastered it, whether it was farming or some kind of engaging work that they could be proud of. They would have been valued members of a smaller community of people who cared whether they lived or died. Some would have spent their lives with gangs of men on ships, but most would have been bound to provide for and protect their families, their own small clans. This was a workable compromise between gang life and family life. A few generations ago, these men would have had meaningful responsibilities, and their actions would have had the potential to do more harm than merely hurting someone's feelings or causing them to be inconvenienced. They would have had pressing reasons to try to be good at being men, but also to be good men. Not so long ago, these men would have had dignity and honor. In the future that globalists and feminists have imagined, for most of us, there will only be more clerkdom and masturbation. There will only be more apologizing, more submission, more asking for permission to be men. There will only be more examinations, more certifications, mandatory prerequisites, screening processes, background checks, personality tests, and politicized diagnoses. There will only be more medication. There will be more presenting the secretary with a cup of your own warm urine. There will be mandatory morning stretches and video safety presentations and sign-off sheets for your file. There will be more helmets and goggles and harnesses and bright orange vests with reflective tape. There can only be more counseling and sensitivity training. There will be more administrative hoops to jump through to start your own business and keep it running. There will be more mandatory insurance policies. There will definitely be more taxes. There will probably be more Byzantine sexual harassment laws and corporate policies and more ways for women and protected identity groups to accuse you of misconduct. There will be more micromanaged living, pettier regulations, heavier fines, and harsher penalties. There will be more ways to run afoul of the law, and more ways for society to maintain its pleasant illusions by sweeping you under the rug. In 2009, there were almost five times more men either on parole or serving prison terms in the United States than were actively serving in all of the armed forces. If you're a good boy, and you follow the rules, if you learn how to speak passively and inoffensively, if you can convince some other poor, sleepwalking sap that you are possessed with an almost unhealthy desire to provide outstanding customer service or increase operational efficiency through the improvement of internal processes and effective organizational communication, if you can say stupid shit like that without laughing, if your record checks out and your pee smells right, you can get yourself a J-O-B. Maybe you can be the guy who administers the test or authorizes the insurance policy. Maybe you can be the guy who helps make some soulless global corporation a little more money. Maybe you can get a pat on the head for coming up with the bright idea to put a bunch of other guys out of work and outsource their boring jobs to guys in some other place who are willing to work longer hours for less money. Whatever you do, no matter what people say, no matter how many team-building activities you attend or how many birthday cards you get from someone's secretary, you will know that you are a completely replaceable unit of labor in the big scheme of things. No sprawling bureaucracy or global corporation can ever love you. They have public relations budgets and human resources departments to protect their interests and their bottom line. There is no us. A legal entity can't care if you live or die, or if you're happy. If you're a good boy, if you're well-groomed and have a J-O-B, and you learn to say the right things, maybe you can convince a nice girl to let you give her a baby and help her pay for it. If that's not your thing, You can spend your money getting drunk or busy yourself trying to hump whatever piece of ass strikes your fancy. Sex, after all, is social in the Bonobo Masturbation Society. You'll have the hard-won right to rub yourself against whatever makes you feel good, as long as you follow the rules. If you're a good boy, you can curl up in the womb of your safe little Soviet Nouveau block apartment with your comfy stuff and enjoy your measured indulgences, your gourmet food, your microbrew. You can busy yourself trying to master the art of erasing your own carbon footprint. Or you can do your part by biking to work, weaving recklessly through a barrage of trucks and cars that could crush you for the sheer thrill of it. Maybe you'll take a class and get your permit, and after another clerk confirms that you are competent enough to be licensed and properly insured, you'll be able to do something really crazy, like ride a motorcycle. Maybe you'll pay someone to let you play a game, or run a race, or put on a safety harness and climb fake rocks. If not, you can always watch someone else do it on TV. Maybe you'll get yourself worked up about some petty inequity or injustice and participate in some nonviolent resistance. Maybe you'll convince yourself that you are making a difference by standing in the same place with other people and shouting angrily at people who don't care. If you prefer, you can get online and vent your confused, impotent, vainglorious rage by playing the anonymous tough guy on some blog or forum. Or you can just say fuck it and spend all of your money on video games that give you the vicarious thrill of slaughtering hordes of aggressive others. You can obsess over your fantasy football team. And there are always hobbies. You can find yourself something harmless and inoffensive to pass the time. Perhaps gardening. You can start a band or tinker with cars. Become a movie buff. You can paint little figurines of warriors. You can even get dressed up in costumes and do live-action role-playing. Whatever you do, just find some way to busy yourself. There's nothing wrong with any of these things. All of them are fun. What is fun if not masturbating your primal brain a little? I like having fun. There's no harm in a little fun, which is why it's called fun and not something deadly serious like survival or war. If that is all, if all your life is about is chasing fun, is that enough? Is this level of civilization, is all of this peace and plenty worth the cost? How long will men be satisfied to replay and reinvent the conflict dramas of the past through books and movies and games without the hope of experiencing any meaningful conflict in their own lives? When will we grow tired of hearing the stories of great men long dead? How long will men tolerate this state of relative dishonor, knowing that their ancestors were stronger men, harder men, more courageous men, and knowing that this heritage of strength survives in them, but that their own potential for manly virtue, for glory, for honor, will be wasted? We know what the way of men has been. Is the way of the bonobo the only way that is left? What is best in life? Quote, day after day, we stuck, nor breath nor motion, as idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean. End quote. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The Epic of Gilgamesh is one of the earliest known works of literature, and it is the product of one of the earliest complex civilizations. It tells the story of Gilgamesh, a mortal man of tremendous natural strength and prowess. No man could stand against Gilgamesh until a goddess fashioned an equal for him, named Enkidu, a wild, hairy man of warlike virtue who knew nothing of the cultivated land. Enkidu was friends with the animals and ranged the countryside helping them, causing woe for trappers and shepherds in the area. The men conspired against him. They sent a naked harlot to tempt Enkidu and tell him of Gilgamesh and of wonders found in the luxurious city of Uruk, so that Enkidu would leave the hills and stop threatening their livelihood. Enkidu was curious, and he longed for a friend who was his peer, another man who would understand him. He followed the harlot to the tents of the shepherds, and she clothed Enkidu and introduced him to bread and strong wine. He joined the shepherds and hunted wolves and lions for them. With Enkidu as their watchman, they prospered. A man came to Enkidu and reminded him of Gilgamesh and the city of Uruk, where Gilgamesh was behaving like a tyrant. Enkidu decided to go to the city and challenge Gilgamesh. The two men fought each other, snorting and shattering doorposts and shaking the walls like two bulls. As they grappled, they gained respect for each other, and the two men decided to become friends. Enkidu and Gilgamesh lived together in the city as brothers. But Gilgamesh was tormented by his own great potential and longed to do something that would be remembered. Enlil, father of the gods, had given Gilgamesh, quote, the power to bind and to loose, to be the darkness and the light of mankind, end quote. Enkidu complained to Gilgamesh that his own arms had grown weak and that he was, quote, oppressed by idleness, end quote. To fulfill their destinies, they knew that they had to leave the comfort of the city and suffer and fight evil together. Gilgamesh cried out to the god Shamash, quote, I have looked over the wall, and I see the bodies floating on the river. And that will be my lot also. Indeed, I know it is so. For whoever is tallest among men cannot reach the heavens, and the greatest cannot encompass the earth. Therefore, I would enter that country, because I have not established my name stamped on brick as my destiny decreed. I will go to the country where the cedar is cut. I will set up my name where the names of famous men are written, and where no man's name is written, I will raise a monument to the gods. The tears ran down his face, and he said, Alas, it is a long journey that I must make to the land of Humbaba. If this enterprise is not to be accomplished, why did you move me, Shamash, with the restless desire to perform it? End quote. If there is a crisis of masculinity, this is it. And the problem is as old as civilization itself. The true crisis of masculinity is the ongoing and ever-changing struggle to find an acceptable compromise between the primal gang masculinity that men have been selected for over the course of human evolutionary history and the level of restraint required of men to maintain a desirable level of order